I think, at Harvard when you were befriended by Professor Richard Evans Schultes, and he is known as the father of ethnobotany. And that influenced you in some way. I love the way, like, you combine, you look at science and poetry. I mean, they're like trying to do the same thing.
And well, oddly enough, I was an English major, but he was, of course, a scientist. We met over a mutual interest in Charles Dickens, and he asked me to be his student assistant. And it turned out that he was the world's greatest expert on how people used plants, that's ethnobotany, but also on hallucinogens. And so I spent almost a year cataloging the hallucinogens in his collection that hadn't been cataloged yet. So I learned all about them. Didn't take them because I didn't want to have to call poison control at Boston and say that I'd taken a bizarre Amazonian seed and was, you know, out of my mind. I didn't take them, but I know a great deal about them. And I learned from reading about them also the other worlds that people saw. And I felt that this had a kind of affinity with the kinds of things I'd seen in fever. Not the same thing. It's a much sort of harsher thing, I think, to take hallucinogens. But I also learned about the shamans of the upper Amazon and their vision quests and their dreams. And I found this all very interesting. And I liked the scientific kind of, you know, looking at the reasons these things happen in the brain. I was always very interested in neurophysiology. And I feel that, you know, science and poetry are, and all creativity come from exactly the same source, this deep inner source.
You talk about at some point being in class, I don't know, you were, I think, 11 years old, something like that, and you were in a geometry class.
Yes.
And it just... can you describe that with that aha moment?
Yes.
You had?
Now that was the aha moment when I became a poet, I believe. It's like science has always inspired me to write poetry because it looks at the natural world in beautiful, logical ways, and then also in some ways looks beyond it. And what happened? I was in a geometry class and we were studying shapes and things. And I looked out the window and I saw the leaves, and I realized that the leaves had geometric forms, and I saw them falling geometrically in regular waves, and that became a poem about leaves based on images of geometry. That was one of my first really more serious poems. I actually hadn't been writing many poems then, but that was the first poem I could really remember. It wasn't a great poem. I was only 11 years old, but it was an interesting concept.
So you were really, you really somehow...
The two came together.
And I think that you mentioned in the essay that was written either about you or that you wrote, the play of words... obtuse and congruent.
Yes.
That it was like,
I love those words. Obtuse and congruent, and the leaves, you know, shapes obtuse and congruent. Floating high on the autumn air, motions precise and fluent. I still remember a little of that poem. Yeah, and I love the way that I love these words. I love the terminologies of science. My first novel, Immersion, which I wrote about the jungles of Costa Rica and the feeling I was having of the unity between all the living things in the jungle and the beautiful forms in the jungle and the scientific background of it, also kind of came up of that desire to use scientific vocabulary and poetic vocabulary together. I don't see any contradiction. I mean, words are our ways. They're the great human art form, and they're our ways of looking at the universe. And it doesn't matter to me what field they come from. They have a great depth and subjectivity and a huge history, every word we speak.
It's almost like you're talking about words in as music.
Yes, they're very musical in a way, or music is words. Take it either way you want. You know, the great medieval cathedrals were seen as frozen music in their forms. And, you know, this idea of the logic of music, words, mysticism, inspiration, poetry, this is not new. This is an ancient concept that I think comes with being human.
I'd love for you to share with us another poem about jaguars and when jaguars licked salt from my hands.
Yes.
And is this more of a like a fevered sort of poem?
Well, it's not fevered. The fevers, you know, fever appears in a lot of my poems. This doesn't necessarily appear as a fevered poem, but this is a poem of putting yourself in a kind of trance-like state and seeing how you can, like, talk about the world in ways that aren't quite ways we usually talk about it. So it's not autobiographical. Obviously, if it were autobiographical, I wouldn't have hands. Jaguars do not. They're 350-pound beasts. They're the biggest predator in the Amazon, and they would not take kindly to being fed salt. But it's a way of looking at the world from a different perspective and looking at how dreamlike the jungle is. The jungle is you know, nature's one of nature's greatest art forms. It's amazing, brilliant, beautiful beyond anything human beings could have ever conceived of, living in one complete, unified, living being. And this is a way of kind of moving into that and then looking at the loneliness of coming out of it and coming away from it. So I'll read it to you.
Please.
When jaguars lick salt from my hands, burning jungles once spread out beneath me, carpets of flame that moved and twisted, following the silver snake of the river like an evil prophecy. I remember a hot, green day when jaguars licked salt from my hands and the shamans turned my body into a bag of birds. How they pried open my mouth and stuffed me with parrots, macaws, crested eagles, fire eyes, monitas, tinamous, and cotingas, filled my lungs with feathers, stripped off my skin, and replaced it with a layer of greasy down the color of rotten mangoes. I remember how my hands became claws, my nails talons, how when I tried to speak, 1,000 beaks came out of my mouth, and my tongue broke off at the tip. When they were finished, they wrapped me in a blanket of thorns and tied ropes around their ankles and climbed to the crest of a great tree. Fly, they commanded, throwing me naked and nestless into the air so hot and thick I thought at first I could swim in it. I flew forever before I hit the ground, flew like a hawk looking for prey, flew like a vulture looking for death. Now back in these lands where the leaves turn blood red and the pepper fruits fall to the ground, and everything has a golden diminishment, as if light itself is finally being observed to die. I can still feel those birds trying to beat themselves out of my skull, and I almost take flight again over that vast jungle of nightmares and hallucinations.
Yeah, you really took us on a flight
yes.
with that poem. You begin the book. Not with these flights, but you begin the book in Western Kentucky.
Yes.
And which is a background of yours. Mm-hmm. And it was just a most shocking beginning. And I would love for you to read that first poem, just very poignant and says a lot to us.
I wrote this as a poem, actually as a tribute to women and generally people who are ignored, people who are poorer and ignored, and their strength and their persistence and their the way that they carry on. And it's something I admire. I come from a long line of stubborn, persistent women, you know. And this is called Whenever I Feel Like Complaining. Whenever I feel like complaining, I remember my great aunt Ebby, who 3 days before she turned 76, hand-shucked 40 acres of corn after it was beaten down by a hailstorm, standing on one leg because the other had been eaten off by a hog, which had also eaten off one of her arms, meaning she did it one-legged and one-handed in the pouring rain.
Now, when I opened the book and yeah. I read that poem, I said, oh, well, that's interesting, and it must be a metaphor. But then I turn the page.
Oh, shall I go on?
Please, I turn the page. So you're going to have to share a couple of more poems in this part of the book.
You know, the title of this next poem is Et, which is spelled E-T, Et. Dialectical past tense and past participle of eat. Middle English etten, from Old English eten, akin to Old High German essen, to eat. Latin edere, Greek edmenai. Your great Aunt Ebby has suffered a farm accident, my mother says. What she means, my father says, is a hog at your Aunt Ebby. At all of her, I ask? No, just her left leg and part of her right arm. Think she'll live? I expect so. Those Walker girls are tough. John, my mother screams, how can you stand there and talk about this to Mary as if it's normal?
So that was like shocking. I remember, oh, wait, this really happened.
This is not a metaphor. Yeah.
And then you go on with the next poem.
And you will notice, by the way, that as I read these poems, I'm bilingual in Yankee and Southern because I spent my summers on this farm. While listening to Pincus Zuckerman play Mozart, couldn't you at least have said eaten, my mother whispers. You're a doctor, a well-educated man. No one ever says someone was eaten by hogs, my father whispers. They're et. It's the only possible word. I cannot, whispers my mother, turning pale, cannot stand for, cannot bear to. My mother never finished that sentence, so we never knew if it was the grammar or the hogs that bothered her the most.
That's so great. And then there was Was it the Last Walker that...
The Last Walker Girls, yeah.
The Last Walker Girls.
That's right at the end. When the last... And the family down in Kentucky is Walker here. When the Last Walker Girl died... When the Last Walker Girl died and was put in the family graveyard, the Colbys finally got our farm. They tore down the house. They tore down the chicken coops. They tore down the barn and the shed and the smokehouse where the hams had been smoked and taken down to New Orleans on flatboats. They pulled up the stones that had the names of the uncles who had drowned in the Colorado Gold Rush carved on them, chopped down the orchard, took a bush hog to the blackberry vines. The Colbys planted corn, long, green rows, greener where our hogs had wallowed, greener where our chickens had scratched. Corn, corn, as far as you could see, rows and rows of it rolling over those Kentucky hills, right down to the bottomlands where the Ohio brought them the topsoil it had stolen from the Yankees. We never did find out what happened to Uncle Wid's mules.
Wow. You know, this is like you're really writing about a time in rural America that is really kind of is passing. And I think Wendell Berry, who lives in Kentucky, also...
Still does, and I know him very well, yeah.
And he's written poetry about this.
And he was kind enough to say he liked these poems in this volume. Yeah. But yeah, it was, you know, it's a way of life. It's part of my preservation thing, preserving the jungle, preserving ways of life, letting people see what it's like. And this, of course, when I look at the family farm and what happened to it, you're going from organic family farming to industrial agriculture. And I saw it happen. I mean, I saw it tear down and I saw what happened to it. And I saw the transformation. Yes.
There's one other poem that I really identify. It's called Kin.
Yes.
And I really identified with this with my own Southern roots.
And this is also anybody who's ever lived in a small town. Okay. But it's really Southern. And I'm going to do that. I'll go into the Kentucky here. Kin. We were related to everybody in Hamilton County, literally everybody, judges and lawyers and county clerks and barbers and druggists and soda jerks and moonshiners and farmers and ferry boat captains and the rich people in the big white houses and the poor ones down by the slough. Total strangers would come up to you as soon as you saw you on the street, throw their arms around you and say, "My great-grandma's buried next to your great-grandma," or "I'm your cousin 7 times removed on your third uncle's side," or my, you look just like your daddy. Has he ever got out of prison?
Everybody knows everyone. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here just being delighted with the work and the conversation with Mary Mackey, and her most recent book is called The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams, New and Selected Poems, 1974 to 2018. And if you want to know more about her work, go to her website, marymackey.com. She spells her last name M-A-C-K-E-Y, marymackey.com. Or you can give there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with poet and novelist and screenwriter Mary Mackey, and her most recent book is The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams, New and Selected Poems, 1974 through 2018. And Mary, now I'm going to switch. We've just come from the first of the book. I'm going to go to the end of the book, and there's this one poem that kind of brings that early rural Kentucky together with the Brazilian rainforest. And so can you introduce this poem for us?
Yeah, it's called Jacob's Ladder, which is obviously a biblical reference. And a lot of the poems that I have in Brazil, Portuguese is the main language of Brazil. And some of my Brazilian poems, I've put Portuguese in them as a kind of chant. And if you understand Portuguese, you get it. And if you don't, it doesn't matter because it's translated in the next line. But I use Portuguese because I think of the beauty of words. You know, once again, my affection to words and their weaving in. And so this is a poem that speaks about the Portuguese. This has some Portuguese in it, and then it also has some of the Kentucky in it. And it does. It brings the whole book together as a kind of unity, and it's the last poem in the book. And it's called Jacob's Ladder. My great aunts, hair done up in braids, calico feed sack dresses, aprons full of chicken feed, knew absolute silence, breath of a candle, hiss of a coal oil lamp, the cackle of a laying hymn. But what would they have said if I'd spoken to them in Portuguese? Queridas tias, dearest aunts, the jungle is thicker than corn, mais grosso do que o milho, greener than cucumbers, mais verde do que pepinos, filled with black lagoons that shine like obsidian. Queridas tias, dearest aunts, sooner or later, mais cedo ou mais tarde. We all stand at the foot of a ladder that's missing rungs, speaking in tongues no one can understand.
So there you really bring them together in mm-hmm. some way, and then you leave us
and then, you know,
with
you,
that
elegiac sort of, you know, ending there. Foot of a ladder that's missing rungs. When people die, the ladder misses rungs, you know. You no longer can.
Those are the kinds of poems for me that just, I pause, I read them again, I pause, I read them again, and then I, for myself, if I'm lucky and take the time, or choose to take mm-hmm. the time, and just let it sit with me, mm-hmm. and let it work on me in this kind of sub-languaged way.
Yeah, I try. Everything I write is layered so that you get one thing on it, but then it goes, there are other layers under it, and that it should reward you with repeated readings if you want to read it over again. And then, of course, when I revise and when I do it, I sit with them and I read them over and over. Everything I have ever written has been read out loud, including every word of all 14 novels that I have written. I read everything out loud, a trick I picked up from Flaubert, and I really like it a lot. And I used to teach creative writing with a lot of having students read out loud because it's a very good way to understand what you're doing in a more complex way.
You know, that's something that I do, too. I try and read something out loud, even when I'm writing a fundraising letter, which I have to do frequently to support this work. And I'll read it out loud and listen to the flow of it and mm-hmm. listen to the words and try and really say, is this really saying what I want to say? Yeah. Is this conveying what I'm feeling? Mm-hmm. What my sincere, is it authentic?
Yeah. And also, you know, for poetry, but also in prose, I'm interested in the rhythms of my sentences. I'm interested in how they go together. I want a smoothness and a feeling of ease and a feeling that it just flowed out of my head that way. But, of course, it didn't.
Yes, yes. So let's talk about that writing process. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your process of writing.
I write all of my novels on a computer with a lot of research, and I write about from about, oh, you know, 9 in the morning till about 2 in the afternoon, about 5 days a week, depending on what I'm having to do otherwise. And I've done this for many years.
And I think you turn off your phones.
No, I turn off my phones. I turn off everything. I put a sign on my door that says writing, you know, so I'm not to be disturbed. And I go into that very centered, almost meditative space of writing for my novels. And sometimes in my novels, when I'm working out plots, I'll do light trancing to work out the plots. And then I always stop when I'm in a good place in a novel so that I can come back the next day and not feel, you know, like I can't get started again. So I'll stop. And then I always start every morning with revision, and I'll revise what I'm writing and put it together. With the poems, it's a different process. It's not completely different, but I write them and always write them first version in longhand. I never touch a computer because I feel the computer gets in the way of centering on what's happening with the poem. I'll write it out in longhand in cursive. I'll write a couple of versions in cursive till I get one that I like pretty well. Then I'll put it on a computer, and then I'll start revising it on the computer. I'd say my poems go through a minimum of about 12 revisions every poem. I let them sit a while and come back to them. I'm very careful. Every piece of punctuation, every word, every line break has been thought out. I believe in spontaneously looking at your inspiration, but then I believe in making this something for other people to read and something that's a work. I strive for beauty in my poetry as well as depth.
What would you say if people decide, okay, I'm going to give myself a writing process and I'm going to commit to how many days a week and this many hours and sit down? And what if we sit down and nothing comes?
Oh, I love that. I love to be asked that question because that's probably the most common question students ask you and something I've asked myself a lot. So what I do if nothing comes is I have two choices. I can sit there and I can write on what I'm working on or write a poem or something. I can write about why I can't write. And I have to write about why I can't write. And I tell you, if you write about why you can't write for 3 hours, you'll start writing something else out of sheer boredom. Something will happen to you. There's a breakthrough. And a lot of times you have to kind of get all the other stuff out before you can get to what you're actually going to. And when I was teaching in my office, I had a row of my published books, which is 14 novels and 8 collections of poetry. They were there. But above them were manila envelopes full of why I can't write. And I had a stack equally bigger, a bigger stack of why I couldn't write. And I used to say, this is not the end of the, if you can't write, it doesn't mean you can't write. It means you need to be writing even if you can't write. And so, you're just not allowed up. You're just sort of committed to it and you can't get away from it. And, you'll have two choices. You can either work on something that's fun or you can write about why you can't write.
So you're saying just keep writing.
Just sit down there and keep writing. And, you can write, I can't write. I don't know why I'm doing this. This is idiotic. Why did she tell me I have to do this? I'm not going to do this. I'm in rebellion against this. I know I can't write. I'll never be able to write. I'm not good as a writer. You just write all this stuff.
Yeah.
And sooner or later, there'll be a little crack in your consciousness and it'll come there. The other thing you have to do at the same time, however, is not show it to anybody. It's very important that you write without fear of criticism. To have a critic on your shoulder is to be paralyzed. It's the most common block. You don't want to give this stuff particularly to anybody you're emotionally close to, like a partner or a relative, and you mostly don't want anybody to see it. I've dedicated all my recent books to my husband, and he doesn't see them until they're published. Because, it's the criticism early on in work can destroy the energy that's making the work happen. And most people, everybody writes bad rough drafts. Every single famous writer, or not famous writer, but who's a good writer. But most people don't see anything but the published version. So you have to understand that until it's published, you can do anything you want with it. Anything can be fixed.
Woodby, you've been publishing for a long time now, quite a few decades.
Yes.
How do you see publishing has changed? What advice do you have for people
these days? It's changed tremendously. Some ways bad, some ways good. In the good way, more people can publish their own books and get books out there. And there's not such a, it used to be there were about 10 big publishing houses and you either got published by them or you didn't get published, period. And so that has changed. However, the downside of losing that and having that, there are two big downsides. One is that there's no supervision, there's no guidance, there are no gates. So people are putting out work that's not very good in books that look like regular books, and then people buy them and they don't want to buy, not only don't want to buy more of them, they don't want to buy books. They have a problem with that. The other thing is that you can't, even no matter how good your book is, there's so much cyber clutter right now that it's impossible to get through the cyber clutter and find books you like. The major papers no longer have, most of them no longer have regular reviewers. They're using stringers if they're using that. The papers are being inundated, overcome by competition from websites where people review books, and you all know who these people are. These are anonymous reviews. They could be lovers of these people. They could be enemies. They could be paid, and they have been, to review. So if you see great reviews on a book, you have no idea if they're real. So the authenticity, the truth of what's being said has been greatly diluted about books. So that's very bad. The worst thing, however, for a writer is that now you're expected to do your own publicity. Most writers in the past like to be quietly go away and write, and then if you got a book published, you had a publicity agent, they might send you on a tour, they would publicize your book. Now, if you wish to continue to be published as a writer, you must do your own social media. This takes a huge amount of time away from writing. It eats the brain. It's very, very difficult for writers to do this. And there's so many people out there saying, look at me, look at me, look at me, that once again, the cyber clutter gets in the way of good writing. Even famous writers now must do a lot of publicity. There's some people who are rich enough to pay other people to do it for them, but that's the exception. And it's also making it hard for good writing to get published.
It's so true, all that you're saying. And me as a recipient of those books and writing and PR campaigns, and for me to kind of sort through it. And then once in a while, there is a gem. And that's a gem that shows up once in a while with all the dross that also comes. But we've got to end this conversation. We've run out of time. I just want to thank you so much for being with us, Mary.
Thank you for having me here. It's been a great pleasure.
It's been my pleasure as well. If you want to know more about Mary Mackey and her work, you can go to her website, marymackey.com. And she spells her last name M-A-C-K-E-Y. MaryMackey.com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. Okay, this is program number 3695.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. This program was recorded at Strawberry Hill Productions, a full-service podcast production studio in Novato, California. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. Most baby birds are adorable little floops, but not all of them. Baby estrel did finches look downright creepy. About 140 species of estrel did finches, including waxbills, parrot finches, and fire finches, are spread across Africa, Asia, and Australia. Newborn finches beg their parents for food, mouths wide open. The tongue and palate are strangely spotted and ringed. Most species chicks have mouth markings in colors ranging from black or white to bright yellow, orange, red, or blue. The function of these markings has long puzzled scientists. Some say that they make baby beaks visible to parents, delivering food to poorly lit nests. Others think the markings signal the health of the chicks. And there's a third school of thought. Other birds target the nest of some African finches for egg dumping, sneaking their eggs into the finch's nest. And those foster chicks have similar colorful markings. So perhaps mouth markings evolved due to competition for food between finch babies and those other bird babies. It's not yet settled whether foster babies mimic the mouths of finch babies or vice versa. Either way, they look equally bizarre. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.